one second. Be seated. Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Glad to have you this morning. I think there are a couple of interns in the office
to get ill, and Uncle Lester and Aunt Vicki came and got the grandmother and the children and moved them to Young County, Texas. Miss Sutton had no idea that this had occurred and went down there to try to get the kids back, wasn't able to do that. The court got involved in March of 2003. The grandmother died and left the children with Vicki and Lester. Obviously, Your Honor, may it please the court. I am at a slight bit of a disadvantage having not argued before this court before. I'm usually in the Eastland Court of Appeals since I'm from Abilene. So I'm not sure exactly if you have rules about what you want to hear and what you don't want to hear, but I'll start, and I'm sure you'll stop me if I'm getting into things you don't want to hear.
Well, we've read the briefs, and we're knowledgeable about the facts.
Right, and I have no intention of reciting the facts, but I would like to just hit some of the high points to put everything in context,
sure,
if that's okay. We're talking about a termination case here. Melissa Sutton is our client. Melissa was 15 when she had the first child in this case. She was living with her mom in Louisiana. The child was, I think, in the custody of the grandmother pursuant to some kind of a CPS-like involvement with the state of Louisiana. Melissa was there with the child but was having help from her mom. The father of that child left before the child was even born, and no one saw him since then. When she was 18, she had another child, again, still living with her mother in Louisiana. Dad left after the kid was 5 months old, and no one ever saw him again. And then child number three was fathered by a man who she doesn't even know. They lived there in Louisiana. Her mother began to get ill, and Uncle Lester and Aunt Vicki came and got the grandmother and the children and moved them to Young County, Texas. Miss Sutton had no idea that this had occurred and went down there to try to get the kids back, wasn't able to do that. The court got involved in March of 2003. The grandmother died and left the children with Vicki and Lester. Obviously, some legal proceedings ensued, and the trial court named the Mitchells and Melissa as joint managing conservators and gave her some visitation. I think the record shows that Aunt Vicki made it pretty difficult for Melissa to do any of that visiting. Wouldn't let her talk to the children on the phone, told her they weren't there when she came to visit, and there were continuing problems with her trying to maintain contact with that child. In August of 2006, the department removed the children because Vicki apparently showed up at the courthouse or at the police department and said, "I can't take it anymore." And after further investigation, they realized that the Mitchells had actually been abusing these children. So the department filed for protection and at that time asked for conservatorship as well as termination of all the fathers and the mom, and my client in this particular case. There was a temporary order entered, and the department was named managing conservator, and no visitation was set up. At that point, there was a service plan, I think maybe 4 or 5 months later, with an attempt to reunite. The stated purpose of that plan was to reunite the mom with the children. In February of 2007, she was in a motor vehicle accident, which, according to her testimony, kept her from being able to get to the children, and she missed the visit. There was another hearing, some kind of interim hearing, and the judge said, "Sorry, no more. You're not getting any more visitation." I think that sets the stage kind of for what happened next. In October, there was a permanency hearing order, and it set that case for trial on January the 14th of 2008. At that permanency hearing, there is no evidence in the record that Melissa was there or her attorney. At that time, David Wimberly was her attorney. There's all kinds of little boxes on the order, but none of them were checked off, and neither Mr. Wimberly or Ms. Sutton signed off on it, where the other parties did. At that point, some 3 weeks later, the new attorney, which was Mr. Eves, and he's the one who tried this case, was appointed to represent Melissa in an Attorney General's Office contempt case. That's a different cause number. I mean, it was a different case. It was a different proceeding being taken, going through a different avenue. And it rocked along. And in December, on December the 11th, Mr. Eves was appointed as the lawyer in the termination case. So prior to December 11th, he had no involvement or no authority to act for Ms. Sutton in the termination proceedings. Trial was set for January the 14th of 2008, and the attorney moved for a continuance, citing lack of notice. That was not ruled on until they actually got to trial, and at that point, the judge said, sorry, we're going forward. It's our position that Rule 254 requires that 45 days notice be given to the parties before they have this final hearing. The record shows, and I think if you look at both the clerk's record and the testimony from Mr. Eves, the record shows that he didn't actually receive his notice until sometime in the first or second week of December 2007. There's not any letter from the court in the trial, in the clerk's record or in the file. There's not any evidence other than his testimony and the logical progression from the dates of the filings in the file.
But she was aware of it in October.
She was, Your Honor. She was aware of it. And I think as far as that goes, she was aware of it, but we're talking about a woman who, I think it's the record's rife with references to her limited ability as far as being able to represent herself. She had no intention of representing herself. She didn't ask to represent herself. She had an attorney at one point in time. He didn't get the notice of this. So her personal notice in this particular instance is not, it's our argument, it's not particularly helpful.
Well, we have a case that says the 45 days is only for the first sitting. Do you have a case that says it's not?
I do not, Your Honor. But our argument is that first setting notice, while it may have been to Ms. Sutton, was not to the attorney that was representing her. And giving it to her is meaningless, and that she's got absolutely no way to prepare herself for this proceeding, this type of proceeding of this magnitude. No, I don't, Your Honor, have any case authority for the fact that there's... I believe that that's correct. But it's our position that this was the first setting for purposes of both Mr. Eves and the Ms. Sutton in this case. She can't represent herself in this. And again, she didn't assert any right to represent herself. She was relying on the court-appointed attorney system to get her a lawyer to represent her in this particular proceeding.
Was this trial set, this second trial setting, was it still within the 1 year?
Yes, and the reason was, I mean, this was kind of the end of the line. They were running out of time. I mean, they couldn't have I don't know that how much time they had, and I think there may have been something in the record about that. I mean, this is kind of the end of the road. They were running out of their window of opportunity to get this case heard.
Well, you're not taking the position that if you change lawyers, it's no longer the first setting. It's now a new first setting because you have a new lawyer.
No, Your Honor, I'm not. Our position is that the first setting was communicated to Ms. Sutton. There's no evidence that was communicated to any lawyer that was representing her. And I'm not sure in October 2007 if she even had a lawyer appointed to represent her. The only reference I have in the records that I've seen was that David Wimberly was her lawyer at the time that they had the in October of 2007 when they did there was a withdrawal and an order of substitute, I believe, and that was when the AG case came along.
Well, this says, on June 22nd, she got notice of the October 5th setting. In October, she got notice of the January setting. So there's notice both times of both hearings. Now, I don't think it may not be 45 days between, well, yeah, it is. If she got notice in October of 2007, that's more than 45 days away from January 14th.
Well, it's our position, Your Honor, that there's no evidence that she got notice in October of 2007. There's a piece of paper in there that has, I mean, there's an order in there on this October 27th or October 25th date, and it has boxes checked off for who all's there and who all's not there. But it's not checked. None of those boxes are checked that say she was there or her attorney was there. And on that order itself, all the parties, including the ad litem for the children, the attorneys for the ad litems for the father, the attorney for the department, they signed off on that order, but there's no signature from either Ms. Sutton or from the attorney that was...
So you disagree with the testimony of Mancilla, who testified that Sutton was at the October 4th hearing?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I don't think there's any evidence in the record to support that other than her testimony. I think that the documents don't reflect that.
Okay.
And I think at the heart of this, our argument may be more equitable, and that is that notice to Ms. Sutton in this particular case was not effective notice. She was not the party representing herself. She had not asserted any, and I believe that the case that we're talking about, the case that this department cited was a case that involved a person who was representing himself. And I could be mistaken, but I believe that that's the case that's come into your position.
What was your harm?
Pardon?
What harm have you shown?
The harm, I believe, is shown by not only the statements made by Mr. Eves and that he needed more time to prepare. There were things that he needed time to get into that he didn't have the opportunity to get into. Now, he wasn't specific about what those things were. But I think in light of the limited education of this woman, the limited resources that she had, the fact that this was not necessarily your run-of-the-mill case where mom just abandons the children and doesn't come back. And this is a little bit different situation. We've got a situation where mom's involved at first, and then Uncle Lester and Aunt Vicky take the kids off. And she's trying throughout this period to get back with those kids. Now, she doesn't have the means, the financial means, and the methods of necessarily doing that, and she's trying to avail herself of the authorities and their assistance, but they're pretty much telling her to go to trial. She doesn't have the means, the financial means, to do that. So throughout all of this, she's wrestling with the fact that she can't do this by herself. And she has availed herself of the system. She's asked the court for representation. She gets representation, and he's not allowed to fully develop the case because he doesn't have enough time.
Didn't she initially have another lawyer?
Well, that's referenced, but there's not, I don't see, I mean, it's referenced in an order where it shows that he's appointed. I don't see any evidence of it in any hearing transcripts, he's never signed off on anything. It doesn't show that he's present at any of these proceedings. I can't find any evidence in the court's record that he was actually there. But I know that from what I've seen, he wasn't there in October of 2007. When this hearing, or the second, or the, in October, when the first notice allegedly came out,
can we go on to a constructive abandonment?
Yes,
which I believe is my understanding. That's what the department is relying on.
Right, and I think, well, there were several findings that the court made, and that was. Again, this goes back to an argument that I've touched on briefly, and that is with regard to the first two findings on the knowingly placing the child in danger or endangering the child himself. I think that the record showed that that's not really actually how it went down in this case. She didn't put those children with the Mitchells. The department and the court put those children with the Mitchells. So it's not like she said, here, please take care of my kids and I'm, you know, I'm going off to do whatever. They took the kids, they put the children with the Mitchells, the Mitchells came and got the kids. She got involved at one point in time and tried to get them back, and the court said, well, no, we're going to let the Mitchells have them, and we're going to let you have some visitation, but we're not going to let you designate where they live. So they stayed with the Mitchells, and she continued. I think the record shows, even by confirmation from the children in chambers with the judge, that Aunt Vicki was not helping her, was not letting her see those children, that she was having trouble doing that. And the other issue goes to, I believe, she didn't visit these children as often as she should have. She didn't visit them as often as she wanted to. I think the evidence shows that she lived in the Metroplex area somewhere. These kids are in Graham. She didn't have the means, the financial means, or the wherewithal to get where she needed to get. And the department didn't assist her in that. There was no evidence that they said, hey, here's how we'll help you, we'll meet you halfway, we'll get with you and get you a bus pass, we'll do something to help you get there. She didn't have a car, it had been totaled. She didn't have a job at that time, so she didn't have the money to get down there to visit those children.
At one time, didn't she move to Oklahoma from the Metroplex area? And then she was even further away from the children?
I believe that is true, Your Honor, and I also believe that move was relatively short-lived. I can't, honestly, off the top of my head, I don't remember the timing of that and when that occurred. But I believe that was a brief recurring lapse in judgment, maybe, with regard to a gentleman friend that she met.
She also testified that she could have lived in Graham, but she didn't want to. She wanted to live somewhere else.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Apparently, she testified that she could have moved to Graham to be close to her children, but she didn't want to. She wanted to live somewhere else.
At that point, I believe, if memory serves, that she was living with someone who was helping her financially, and that's the person that she chose to stay with. Yes, Your Honor.
I believe your time is up.
May it please the court, counsel. Let's clarify something quickly. The department never placed the children with the Mitchells. That was a private situation where Grandma was getting ill. The Mitchells, I think, were aunt and uncle. And that was a situation where the department wasn't involved at all. The department didn't get involved until August 3rd of 2006. Now, there's a question. I think the crux of this whole case focuses on the October 5th, although the testimony, for some reason, the testimony all talked about the October 4th hearing. It seems like the hearing was on October 5th of 2007. I believe it is the key to this whole case. Counsel said that there was no evidence in the record that Miss Sutton was there or that Mr. Wimberly, who was her attorney at the time, was there. There is some in the record. Now, I realize that usually the docket sheet is not part of the record, but the docket sheet can be used when there is some ambiguity that can be cleared up by use of the docket sheet. At 150 of the court's record, actually 151, it talks about 10-5-07, and it says Dennis D. Wimberly appeared for Melissa Sutton. And also in that same on that same date, it says appointed Jeffrey Eves as attorney for Melissa Sutton. So, October 7th, Mr. Wimberly was at, or October 5th, 2007, Mr. Wimberly was at that hearing, and he was there representing Miss Sutton. As you pointed out, Justice McCoy, we had testimony from Miss Mancia that said Miss Sutton was at that October hearing as well. There is not when you look at the argument made in Ms. Sutton's brief, there is not one single reference to the record about Ms. Sutton saying, I was never there, I didn't know the case was involved. In fact, counsel admitted in oral argument that she wasn't notified in October. But not only was she notified, her attorney was notified. I have a couple of cases that I would like to talk about that I did not talk about in my brief. The first of them, although this one is in my brief, it's O'Connell v. O'Connell, but I did not cite it for this proposition. On page 215, 216 of O'Connell v. O'Connell, the Texarkana Court of Appeals holds that notice to a former attorney can be imputed to a party because the agency relationship existed at the time the notice was received. And they said that constructive notice to the party through the attorney at the time, the former attorney at the time, was sufficient for Rule 245. And as we stated, we used Izagari in our brief to point out that Ms. Sutton knew about the first setting in June of 2007, so she was notified personally when she was still pro se. And if you look at clerk's record page 150, at the June 22, 2007 setting, it says that Ms. Sutton appeared pro se. So Ms. Sutton at the time did not have an attorney during the June 22nd hearing. She did, however, have Mr. Wimberly, who was notified of the hearing at that date. So although Mr. Eaves was not notified until December, Ms. Sutton was notified way before in June. Then her first attorney was notified in October, which, Your Honor, you sounded like you were almost as good at math as I was. We're talking October to November to December to January. We're talking basically nearly 100 days that Mr. Wimberly had notice and that Ms. Sutton had constructive notice through Mr. Wimberly. And as April Mancia testified, she also was there. In the permanency hearing order, one clerk record 70, page 72, it lists David Wimberly as the attorney of record for Sutton for that October hearing. So we have plenty of evidence in the record that Wimberly was her attorney for this, that he was present, and that he was notified. Now let's talk about the claim that Ms. Sutton really didn't know what she was doing, that she really didn't have the capacity to completely understand what was going on. Let's look at the evidence of her knowledge that a trial had been set for January 14th. At 3 RR 25, testimony is that Sutton went for more than a full year without completing her service plan from August of 06 to October of 07. At 3 RR 25, again, the court granted an extension to give Ms. Sutton more time to work on her services. Now, what's important, I believe, to show Ms. Sutton's state of mind and to show her notice, that to show that she had noticed that that hearing was set as of October of 2007. At 3 RR 26, Sutton, who had done nothing for over a year, 14 months, suddenly completed her parenting classes in 4 weeks. The testimony was it usually takes 8 weeks. At 3 RR 27, the testimony was that Sutton had completed 3 of the required 12 counseling sessions in January of 07, and then just quit. Suddenly, between October of 07 and November of 07, a four-week period in between the middle of those two-and-a-half-month period, in that 4 weeks, she finished all 9 of her sessions that she was still supposed to do. So there is evidence in the record that Ms. Sutton, as of October 7, kicked it into high gear trying to finish up all of her services because she knew about that hearing coming. I want to talk about notice. I cite Izagari about personal notice in a hearing. There's also a case that I believe I did not mention in my brief. I should have. I apologize. It's in the interest of KMH. It's out of the 14th Court of Appeals. It's 181 Southwest 3rd, page 1. On page 7, note 1, there's an argument that the father had not been notified of the termination hearing, final hearing, and the court in footnote 1 says, the record shows that on September 30, 2003, the trial court signed an initial permanency hearing order notifying the parties the case was set for trial on March 16, 2004. That would have been our June 22, 2007 initial permanency hearing review order. Also signed, notifying of the first final hearing setting. Ms. Sutton was there pro se. The trial court later signed a subsequent permanency hearing order on January 20, 2004, again notifying the party was set for trial on March 16th. So the trial was moved from January 20th to March 16th in a subsequent hearing, permanency hearing order. So we have basically the same situation in this case as we did in that case. What the KMH court, the Houston 14th court said in KMH, is that signing those orders, putting in the final hearing dates in those orders, is sufficient notice. And it doesn't even say that Mr. Hoback, who was the appellant in this case, it doesn't even say that he attended either of those hearings. As I've shown by the evidence in the record, Ms. Sutton was at both of these hearings, and her attorney was at the October 7th hearing. Let's also talk about visitation. June 22nd was a very busy permanency hearing, There was a period between February and June 23rd where Ms. Sutton had no visitation whatsoever. And that occurred because Ms. Sutton admittedly said, I wasn't visiting. I didn't visit. Now, counsel said in February she lost her vehicle. February 23rd, I think, was the day she had a car accident. And she didn't have a vehicle anymore. She lost visitation prior to that because she missed a visitation on February 1st. Of that year prior to the accident. So she had missed visitation. I'm not going to go through the record. It's set out in my brief, but there was a visitation where I believe it was in December or October where she was invited to come visit the kids. It was already set up. She was going to come. The caseworker called the day before on the 10th. The visitation was set up for the 11th. And mother's friend said that she's not going to be able to come to this visit. A friend is in the hospital and she's she's visiting a friend. She's not going to be coming. As I set out, it's pages 5 through 8 of the department's brief sets out the availability of the transportation for Sutton during the pendency of the case. I'm not going to bore you with all of those different things, but I think I do want to point one out to RR173 in the record from a question by the attorney, children's attorney ad litem. Sutton admitted that she was able to get transportation whenever she needed it. She chose not to get transportation. As Justice McCoy, as you pointed out, I believe it was you, sir, that she moved to Oklahoma. It wasn't her, you. It was one of the other justices, and I can't remember which one. Yes, ma'am. Justice Gardner. You pointed out that she had moved to Oklahoma, and that was even farther away. I believe the period she was in Oklahoma was either February of March or March of 07 to June of 07. I believe that was the period. I could be off a couple of months. But the fact was she could have moved to Graham. She chose not to. She chose to go where the boyfriends were. The testimony I have set out in the brief talks about when the children go back and talk to the judge, Judge Crawford, in Chambers. He asked JLS, the 12-year-old boy, have there been times when you've had visitations set up and mom didn't show up? And he went, yeah, that's happened. And he said, how did that feel? And he said, not very good. So we have a situation. I believe we have pretty solid proof. There's nothing in the record against establishing that there was more than adequate notice from the June 22nd hearing of 07 than the October 5 hearing of 07. The fact that Mr. Eaves did not get notice, he was appointed at the October hearing. He received notice in December, which is early, middle December, so he had about 30 days. Our position, the department's position, and I will finish this, the department's position is that was at least a second notice, looks like a third notice to a second attorney, and he had more than 30 days. All 245 requires is reasonable notice. That was reasonable notice. And as this court has written in EAWS, they didn't even show harm if, assuming arguendo, they didn't have adequate notice. Thank you very much for your time.
Just briefly, Your Honors, I too would encourage you to look at the docket sheet, specifically on 10507. And I read it differently than Mr. Hooten does. I would ask you to perhaps look at it a little bit differently. What I believe it says is that the department was there with an attorney, that Vicki Mitchell, who was the aunt, was there, pro se. CASA was present. The ad litem was there. The ad litem didn't appear. Dismiss D. Wimberly. Not Dennis D. Wimberly. It says dismiss D. Wimberly as attorney for Melissa Sutton and appoint Jeffrey Eaves as attorney. That doesn't say Dennis Wimberly's there. It says let's get rid of him. And maybe that's because he wasn't there. But we don't have any evidence in the record that he was there. And I think what is important is that, again, it's and there's no evidence that she's there either. It doesn't say Melissa's here. So we don't have Melissa there, and we don't have her lawyer there, and we've got a new lawyer getting appointed on October the 5th of 2007, and he's not finding out about it until sometime, about this hearing, until sometime in mid-December, which is a month before the hearing starts.
Without casting aspersions on Mr. Eves, who isn't here, of course, to defend himself, one would think if one got appointed, one would check and see if there's any settings or deadlines or anything going on.
With all due respect, Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record that he knew that he'd been appointed. We don't know when he found out that he'd been appointed in this particular case.
Unless he was there.
Pardon?
Unless
he was there, and we don't know that he was.
And I appoint somebody unless they were there like that, but we don't know, as you say.
Unless the judge has a list he's going by and he's just going down the next person in line. I honestly don't know how it went down, and there's no real evidence in the record of that fact. It is our position, Your Honor, that this was a first setting. This was a first setting for Melissa Sutton with her attorney, Jeffrey Eves. And in light of her obvious limitations and her inability to handle this case on her own, in light of the fact that she had asked for and had at least on some level received some kind of a court-appointed lawyer in this case, it's our position that this was the first setting. He didn't have enough time to get prepared. And that kind of all goes back to, yes, there was a flurry of activity in the month before this case went to trial. And because of that, Mr. Eves needed every bit of the time he had to get ready for this case. Obviously, it had a long history and quite an involved history, and there were lots of things that were happening there towards the end that Ms. Sutton was trying to avail herself of that he needed to be able to develop and put forward to the court, and he didn't have that opportunity.
What do we have his motion for continuance?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does it say that as a part of the motion, I didn't even know I'd been appointed?
It does. It states...
Excuse me,
Your Honor. Obviously, he says he was unaware of the setting. Does he say, I'm unaware that I was even appointed in this case?
Give me a minute. Just, no, I've got it. And no, it does not. It does not make that statement.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, the motion for continuance is CR 123, but it states in earlier minutes that he received a confirmation letter regarding the termination trial. It says in early or mid-December he received confirmation of the termination trial set for January 14th. Mount Rose?
Yes.
This is the motion for continuance. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Your case is submitted.